Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Violence erupts in Zimbabwe after the first election since Robert Mugabe was deposed in a military coup last year. And South Africa's president says he's moving ahead with plans to expropriate private property without compensation. Welcome to Foreign Edition. I'm Mary Kissel with the Wall Street Journal editorial board here in New York City. And my guest today is a very special guest, the CEO of the South African Institute of Race Relations based in Johannesburg. His name is Frans Kronje, and you should know his name and you should know about his think tank. Welcome to the show, Frans.
Thanks, Mary. It's good to be on with you.
So let's start with Zimbabwe. Election authorities declaring the incumbent candidate, Emmerson Mnangagwa, president, winning 50.8% of the total vote versus 44.3% for the challenger, Nelson Chamisa. It's the first vote since Mugabe was deposed last November after he spent 37 years in power. There was violence on the streets. Six people died. Frans, has Zimbabwe simply traded Mugabe for Mugabe Jr.? Is this, you know, basically the same ZANU-PF in power?
It's exactly the same. Robert Mugabe, who had been in power for almost 40 years, was deposed last year in a coup that was led by the military. And it was an unusual type of coup because it wasn't staged in order to change the direction of the country, but in order to maintain the status quo. I think many in Mr. Mugabe's ruling ZANU-PF party felt that he was putting their future control of the country at risk, and they therefore staged the coup to remove him in order to increase the odds that ZANU-PF could continue its political dominance of that country, which they have done very successfully in the election of this week.
A political dominance and also economic destruction. Frans, you look at Zimbabwe today versus where it was, three, four decades ago, and it's just a remarkable change. You have the state pretty much spending all of its money to pay off its cronies. You have rampant unemployment. How does any of this change then with this result?
I don't think it does in any significant sense. Zimbabwe was a country of extraordinary potential at the time of independence in 1980. But around 15 years ago, popular dissatisfaction with the rule of Mr. Mugabe and ZANU-PF manifested in the beginning of a civil rights movement that sought to challenge the control of Mr. Mugabe and his party. And the reaction of Mr. Mugabe and ZANU-PF was swift and brutal. And they sought to destroy the Zimbabwean economy, tear it down, mainly through an assault on property rights, knowing all along that that was probably the best strategic option for them, a reign of terror on the back of an economic collapse to maintain control of the country. And as a political strategy, it has worked very well for them, as we saw again this week. Economic destruction complete, extraordinary inflation numbers far in excess of anything that's been recorded in Venezuela, for example. It no longer has a currency, Zimbabwe. It tries to trade here and there in the US dollar. And much of the small middle class and the relatively educated elite, the skills base of the country, has fled into South Africa or into other parts of the world. And I'm afraid under the current leadership, the prospects for economic or political reform are very, very limited.
Well, President Trump extended sanctions on the ZANU-PF leaders just this past March. That, of course, limits the ability of anybody really to transact or invest in the country because the banks and corporates don't want to be subject to sanctions, too. There's also quite a limit on lending from international financial institutions, the IMF and the like, although, as we know from prior experience, the IMF doesn't have the best record of pulling countries out of economic distress. France, the opposition, the MDC alliance, did they have better ideas for Zimbabwe and for economic reform?
Part of the tragedy, that when you look back at the reign of terror, the abuses, the deaths, the destruction of the past 15 years in Zimbabwe, you're tempted to think that almost anything would be better. And I think the political inclination of a number of Movement for Democratic Change leaders, the key opposition party, that grew out of the dissatisfaction with Mr. Mugabe, is better. But in terms of broad ideas, in terms of economic reform, I think they're imprisoned by that same crippling Afro-socialist nationalist approach to policy that actually sat at the heart of a lot of the destruction that Zimbabwe had suffered. And had the MDC won both the parliamentary and presidential races this week, I think the fortunes of Zimbabwe would look better. You would have seen an amount of aid money unlocked for what that is worth. You might have seen some of the sanctions being produced for what that is worth. But to present the MDC as a group, the opposition party, that had the political or policy strategy framework in place to stage the structural reforms, to secure property rights in that country, to reintroduce a market economy, to allow freedom and of action amongst private sector actors and investors, I think that is a bridge too far for them either. And that, in a sense, is the plight of the Zimbabwean people, that whether they look to continue the status quo started by Robert Mugabe or whether they voted for the Movement for Democratic Change, I don't think that in many respects the material circumstances of Zimbabweans would have improved to any significant extent.
Franz, does Zimbabwe have any institutions of civil society, media or NGOs or activists, opposition political organizations that could step away from this election and say, okay, we won in certain parts of the country, mostly the urban areas. How do we get our message out to the rural areas? How do we convince Zimbabweans to vote a different way the next time? Again, understanding that there was election meddling, U.S. European observers have confirmed that. But what I'm really asking is there a way for this situation to change? Are there people and institutions in place that could potentially change it down the road?
I think that's unlikely. There are analysts and observers around who say that inevitably a society that's been through what Zimbabwe has been through and with the potential that Zimbabwe undoubtedly possesses, eventually the popular uprising must come when people get into the streets, the braver amongst them drive the institutions, the foreign and regional support will be there, and Zimbabwe will sort of throw off this yoke of oppression of the past 20 years. But I think it's naive, and it discounts the consequences of 15 years of terror, where a population is so beaten into submission that the ability to resist, particularly in deep rural areas, in which it's very difficult for foreign observers or NGOs or rights groups or the like to see, it's a very opaque area that it becomes, after such an experience, that reign of terror, the ability of a population to resist is very limited indeed. And when that happens, you need foreign intervention or you need regional intervention in order to secure a turnaround. There is no prospect of any significant foreign intervention. And in the region, I'm afraid the balance of power sits the wrong way around for Zimbabwe's people. The very excellent Zimbabwe author and commentator Peter Godwin, also based in New York, said about a week ago that it's a remarkable fact that most of the current ruling parties in southern Africa that came to power through armed resistance movements, the MPLA in Angola, SWAPO in Namibia, the African National Congress in South Africa, Frelimo in Mozambique and ZANU-PF in Zimbabwe, none of them had been deposed since coming to power. And I think the example of ZANU-PF clinging to power after the transition from Mugabe would inspire a lot of confidence in governments around the region that their longevity is pretty much assured if they are able to act with sufficient ruthlessness to terrorize populations or stamp out dissent wherever that dissent begins to arise.
We're talking about Zimbabwe's election. We're turning to South Africa next, and you're listening to Foreign Edition from The Wall Street Journal.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and lowest-cost model on the market, perfectly designed for high-volume, high-speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
Drive time, gym time, anytime. Podcasts from The Wall Street Journal. Check out all our shows at wsj.com/podcasts. That's wsj.com/podcasts.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition. Mary here in New York with Franz Kronje in Johannesburg, South Africa. And we are turning to South Africa, where President Cyril Ramaphosa announced this week that his government is pressing ahead with plans to expropriate private property to, as he put it, unlock economic growth. You can't make this up if you tried. Franz, observers outside the country, like us sitting here in New York, look at this and think, that's just nuts. Any country that's ever done this has gone down the economic black hole. Why in the world is the ruling ANC proceeding?
Well, undoubtedly, Mary, we're starting to see echoes of Zimbabwe and echoes of Venezuela here, and the reasons are very much the same as those that led to the chain of events that collapsed the Zimbabwean economy. South Africa goes through its democratic transition in the 1990s, 1994, the first democratic election. Nelson Mandela comes to power. And he'd done quite a significant thing a few years previously at Davos, recently having been released from prison, where he makes a series of statements that suggest that South Africa will not replicate the Afro-socialist mistakes that had led to the collapse of so many post-colonial African societies. He lends his gravitas to his de facto prime minister, Thabo Mbeki, who would later become a president of South Africa. And together they drive initially in the first decade after 1994 a fairly sensible and even conservative policy framework. Policies of inflation targeting are introduced. Catastrophic growth rates of the 1980s are reversed. And by the mid to late 2000s, South Africa's again averaging growth rates of 4 or 5%. The debt to GDP levels are cut in half. And the budget deficit inherited at negative 5% is turned into a surplus. It's actually a very impressive performance. Living standards are also rising very quickly in the country at the time. But behind the scenes, leftist ideologues within the broader liberation movement that have been isolated through the Mandela and Mbeki years are seething with resentment at what they perceive as a betrayal of South Africa's revolution. Then matters come to a head at a policy conference of South Africa's ruling party, the African National Congress, in 2007, where Mr. Mbeki is ejected. A new leader is chosen, a kleptocratic individual by the name of Jacob Zuma, who will run South Africa's economy into the ground over the decade to today. Growth rates of 5% are will bottom out in 2016 at just over 0%. Debt-to-GDP levels double. The budget deficit back at apartheid-era lows. And while Mr. Zuma might not have been an ideologue, he certainly created a great deal of space for left-wing ideologues, long isolated through the Mandela and Mbeki years, to regain control of the levers of policy power.
And it was Zuma who came up with the idea, was it not, of expropriating private property, reversing Mandela's dictums?
Mr. Zuma, who succeeds Thabo Mbeki, who succeeded Nelson Mandela, was perhaps one of the least ideological presidents South Africa had had.
Mm.
He was best described by a journalist here as a man who never heard an idea he did not like. But his ruthlessness, he was a former director of the African National Congress's internal security division, was particularly ruthless. His ruthlessness matched with the resentment of the left of the party at having been excluded from power, came together in 2007. They needed him to depose Mr. Mbeki, and he needed the platforms that they possessed in order to come to power. A strange bedfellows, as it were, but a fatal combination, as it turned out, made worse for the fact that the change of leadership will be followed 18 months later by the global financial crisis. Levels of corruption escalate very sharply. Mad policy prescriptions follow. Proposals to nationalize mines and banks are made. South Africa will cancel bilateral investment treaties with 13 countries, including the UK. And the investment environment becomes very hostile. And South Africa, as a result of that, doesn't follow other emerging markets out of the crisis. By 2013, as the fragile global recovery is continuing, South Africa's economic growth rate is peeling away sharply downwards. And the trajectory that had been secured in the first decade after the end of apartheid rule, 1994 to around 2007, is broken.
So, point taken, friend. So it's been trending down for a while now. But the new president, Cyril Ramaphosa, was supposed to be a businessman. I put that in quotes, and a reformer. And yet here he is running the country and continuing these policies that we know don't work. Why would the current president keep down this road?
I think the key reason, Mary, is that as living conditions began to plateau and even decline over the past decade, the ruling African National Congress identifies that support for it, particularly in urban areas amongst the emerging middle classes, is starting to slip.
Mm.
Polling on popular confidence in the future of the country will fall over the decade to today by 40 percentage points. And the same reaction that triggered the attack on property rights in Zimbabwe under very different circumstances and in a very different country, South Africa is very different to Zimbabwe, starts to play out. And I think we're seeing a number of things. One is an attempt to establish as a general principle of law the idea of what's called a custodial taking, that the state may assume regulatory control of an asset in order to extract wealth out of the private sector. A second thing that I think we are seeing is an attempt to unite the fractured African National Congress around a common enemy.
Mm.
And the common enemy is the mainly white commercial farming base of the country, who's been subjected to a decade of very hostile, very racist propaganda that has seen them become almost stigmatized. And between those two objectives, cynically, the ruling party is exploiting the historical wrong of the economic exclusion of black South Africans in order to incite tensions, unite the party, and set the precedent that the state can override property rights protections.
Well,
Franz,
understanding
very well and encouraged by what happened in Zimbabwe this week.
I mean, Franz, I mean, this is always the irony, right? If you have a revolutionary party take power,
you can't ever end the revolution, because if you do, then there's no reason to have an African National Congress anymore.
Yeah, well, that's the perpetual revolution is the purpose of many revolutions. There is no end point. I think what's happened to the African National Congress is, under popular pressure, it does not know which way to turn. Its ideological inclination now, especially since banishing the relative pragmatic leadership that hadn't done too badly in the first decade after 1994, means that all they have left to turn to is relatively hardline left-wing ideologues. And that, if that's become the engine of ideas, if you think of it that way, of the ruling party, and the party now fears for its future political control of the country. Over the past decade, the number of violent anti-government protest actions rose by 300%.
Wow.
Then you can start to see strategy at play again, exactly as played out in Zimbabwe. It's a very difficult thing for particularly Western observers to understand. I had a chap in my office, a client in my office earlier this week, who said to me, surely they won't do it because they understand the consequences. And I said to him, you are not thinking this through. What consequences do they understand? If they look at the example of ZANU-PF in Zimbabwe this week, what they see is a liberation government, a revolutionary party that's still in power 37 years later. And that is the benchmark of success. That the price has been this, the collapse of the economy, and sacrificing the promise that the country, the region had to become a free, open, and prosperous community. That is a price worth paying. Some years ago, a former senior policy director in the African National Congress said to me that he wonders whether his party would survive a future of high growth, of job creation, and of the establishment of an independent property-owning middle class, and whether they might not be better off in a future of dependency and state control. And I think that explanation must be factored in to a significant extent.
Well, it's
any current strategic thinking on where South Africa is going.
It's an appropriately gloomy end to a usually gloomy podcast. Sorry about that, folks, but it is the reality of the world and the reality of Zimbabwe and South Africa today. Very grateful to have Franz Kronje from the Institute of Race Relations in South Africa joining the podcast today. Franz, thanks so much for your time.
Mary, a very great pleasure. Thank you to you.
That's it for Foreign Edition this week. Send me your comments at Mary Kissel on Twitter. I read each and every one of them. I'll be back with you on Monday. Have a great weekend.